Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You're scared of things that go boom, boom, boom.
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric, and filling in this week is Michael Kester as my co-host. We got two films today. We have a million hours of two films. What are those films?
Magnolia and Kinky Boots.
I am ridiculously tired, but
I'm ridiculously pumped.
Yeah,
for no reason.
I've been doing stuff for AwesomeStart.com like for the last 2 weeks, and I'm so drained. We usually have a nice, tasty like Mexican beverage for the show. But we both got chemically high on caffeine before the show.
So not to be confused with chemically high on Canadian marijuana.
Yeah.
So, which was something that I had earlier this week.
Something you did not have earlier.
Right. I had offered to me.
So we're gonna just roll right through this, and we're gonna be excitable and caffeinated, and this will be a great show.
I'm so fucking pumped.
All right.
Do you know what I wanna do with these films?
What?
I'm gonna spoil them.
Okay, yeah, we should. There's chapters.
Okay.
Is that it? Are we good? We are going to spoil these. Magnolia has a very like twisty look at the spoiler. So that's going to happen like pretty much right away.
Yeah. Turns out all the...
You can't, man. You gotta wait for the whole warning.
Spoiler warning.
also, I assume Kinky Boots can be spoiled.
Maybe.
So
it's spoiled by the title.
If you want to like skip around, there's chapter markers. You should do that because right now, Magnolia... Do you want to, I know you need to just get this off your chest before we even talk about Magnolia. So can you just say the you want to just make a joke or what do you,
yeah,
what do you need to do here?
In Magnolia, like two people have cancer.
All right, fine. If you don't, you know what? We'll get to it.
So all the frogs have cancer.
All right, there you go. Yeah, there's frogs in this film. The thing about Magnolia that everybody, no one really talks about the frogs,
no.
Which is strange. People always talk about the interconnections between the people. They talk about the themes and they kind of avoid the frogs. So I want to do the opposite here.
Because
if you want to know about themes, and maybe we'll hit that stuff a little bit. If you want to know about that stuff, you can find it. Just Google it. And there's a billion people talking about it. So I don't want to do that here. We are going to talk about the frogs, but I think we're going to do that later.
Yeah.
The first thing I have to get into immediately is, well, I guess what should be Paul Thomas Anderson, the director.
Which, not to be confused with Paul W.S. Anderson.
Yeah, I know, right? Who directed...
Resident Evil.
I was hoping you'd...
And DOA.
There you go. Paul Thomas Anderson is a really interesting filmmaker to me because he's what's considered the first generation of these VCR filmmakers, which would be us if we made films.
What's VCR?
It stands for Video Cassette Recording.
Oh, so that's like a podcast.
Sort of, yeah. Well, it's this generation of filmmakers that didn't go to school. They didn't really like learn the craft in a traditional manner. They basically watched a ton of movies, kind of emulated or just took things from what they saw and created their own films out of that. Quentin Tarantino is a big name in that. Richard Linklater did a lot of that stuff. I think Kevin Smith probably. That guy couldn't have had any training in the art of filmmaking.
I hope he did.
Rodriguez probably did that too. A lot of these directors we talk about a lot.
Rob Zombie for sure.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And I mean, we're not going to go to school before or if we ever get around to making films. So that's kind of how we're learning the craft too. Anderson's known for doing a lot of kind of unconventional stuff, logistically infeasible shots with Steadicam stuff, really long shots. The opening shot of Boogie Nights, it's a really long, you're kind of walking through in and around the club.
Mm-hmm.
You take these really strange ways through scenes where, I mean, you could accomplish the same thing you're doing in that scene by, you know, putting a camera in front of the bartender and then in front of some patrons and then in front of the people playing pool. And you just kind of get a sense of the environment, but instead he chooses the hard route. It always reminds me of like the Chris Angel magic comparison. I'm not going to make a comparison that only like 1% of our audience understands.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But Chris Angel is known for doing a lot of TV magic where he could use a camera cheat to do the trick, but he like takes the hard way.
And instead has frogs fall from the sky.
Just because.
Mm-hmm.
Anderson will take these really roundabout ways of accomplishing the same thing you could, but in kind of a more flashy manner. It's a bit more ambitious. And that's stuff I like to see in film because it's different. Mm-hmm. You've seen the one-on-one shots over and over and over. And when you do something like a longer take like that, I think it kind of draws you in a different way. So that kind of interests me. This is really his second big effort after Boogie Nights. I want to say, I'm pretty sure that's chronologically correct there. Another one of the things he's known for is these big ensemble casts.
Yeah.
I think as far as ensemble cast goes, this has to be like one of the largest.
Yeah, easy. And all of the, there's a bunch of A-list celebrities that I don't even really want to get into right now because personally from coming from the, you know, film background I have, I, you know, big names don't do much for me.
However, this movie does have something else for
you. Oh my God, the B-list of actors in this film is fantastic.
Right. And yeah, it's faces you recognize. Yeah,
so the old lady from Feast is in this movie.
Stuff we've seen on the podcast. Yeah.
You have Alfred Molina from Spider-Man.
Sure.
You have, I don't even know his name. He was one of the adults on the game show.
Luis Guzman.
There were so many people, like especially from horror films, which was exciting for me.
Yeah.
Felicity Huffman also, who's not from a horror film, but she is from like Desperate Housewives, which was scored by Danny Elfman, who also scores horror films.
Well, and then you have just with the A-list stuff. I mean, these are a lot of A-list actors who weren't super huge at the time, but went on. Maybe it's just because I've seen more stuff, but Philip Seymour Hoffman seems like a great example because he went from this to like what the bad guy in Mission Impossible 3.
Right.
I mean, he blew up in a really big way. I mean, you got Julianne Moore, William H. Macy, Tom fucking Cruise, John C. Reilly, Philip Baker Hall, you know, the list goes on and on. One of the things this film really relies on is coincidence. And this is sort of the major buy of the story. If you're going to go along with the message here, you're going to have to buy into the fact that all of these characters can really connect. Mm-hmm. And the movie tries to force that on you almost, I think, too much. I think, you know, you can buy that.
Yeah.
You can buy that people's past coincide.
Yeah,
right?
Sure.
You know, that they're connected in ways they don't understand. That's a big J.J. Abrams thing. He really likes that too. Saw that in Lost. And then I believe the 8 or the 9 or something.
It's the 9.
That, yeah.
Yeah.
That short-lived project he did, which was based solely on the idea that people's lives intertwine. And I buy that. I don't need to, you know, I don't need that like hammered in. But one of the ways he really tries to sell you that in the beginning is through these urban legends of coincidence, which I think are all right to look at them as urban legends. And that's kind of interesting. But the film tries to convince you that these events really happened to the point where the narrator is going, no, really, they really happened. You don't believe me, but they really did happen. And turns out they didn't really happen.
Right.
So you have the big three. The first one, well, the first one did kind of happen. The first one is this story based on Edmund Barry Godfrey, I believe. And they kind of changed the name or whatever. But for all intents and purposes, the most believable and the least like fantastic of the three happen.
Also the least exciting.
Well, yeah. Then you have the big Helitank one.
But that was one of my favorite stories as a child.
This is something that originated in the late 80s. And it's been covered extensively by Snopes. I think the Mythbusters might have even done a thing on it. Basically, this account never really existed. In fact, it's technically infeasible. A helitank has an opening port for the water on it, no bigger than like a foot. I mean, that's even at the largest possible size. It just wouldn't fit a person. Add to that the fact there's no historical kind of that. So whatever, I don't want to like ruin the magic here. But then you have the third one, which is the Ronald Opus thing. And this was something you can actually trace. Rarely do you get this in urban legend, but you can trace down the exact time and date that this was created. This was a story that Don Harper Mills made up. Actually, you want to talk about coincidence, and this is what I'll get to. It was made up in 1987 at the same time that this Helitank story originated or was last pinned to. This was something he made up to kind of illustrate a point he was giving at some sort of speech or something. And then later made its way onto the internet in like the mid 90s and became had this resurgence as a big urban legend kind of thing. Now the point that it's trying to get across, and you know, normally I'll let all that go. All right, that's fine. But the fact that it really tries to hammer it in and that it tries to make the point that this stuff really happened isn't coincidence crazy. And now here's a story about coincidences. I mean, you have right in just in me explaining these urban legends, you have the fact that two of them originate from the same exact year. Right. I think that's coincidence right there. You could certainly come up with three real life events that have coincidence in them. But you know, the fact of the matter is when Anderson wrote this, he either didn't know that these were urban legends, that they were fictitious, or he didn't care. And if he didn't care, I think he probably addressed them in the wrong way.
Right.
And it comes back to them again in the end, mm-hmm. which, you know, maybe it was something in the beginning of the film and I can kind of forget about it. But then at the end it goes, remember the three things that I told you about? Well, see, those really happen. And if this were a film, blah, 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 blah. Yeah. It gets a little meta. Meta always scares me. Ever since Southland Tales, I'm like, I can't even, as soon as things start getting meta, I just tune it out.
I've never seen it work. Yeah. I mean, we have, the biggest one that we've covered on the show would be Wes Craven's New Nightmare.
Sure.
Where it was a film about a film being killed by the characters from the film.
Where the movies that preceded it were fictitious right. in the universe of the newly created yeah. film.
I mean, especially in a series, it betrays your audience. I mean, just from you and me, we sat there for, you know, 8 hours watching, you know, seven films. And then yeah. the last one comes up and it's like, yeah, that was a waste of your time.
Yeah, for sure.
Thinking one-offs like this film, specifically the Philip Seymour Hoffman scene where he's on the phone. He's like, so if this were a movie,
yeah,
this would be the scene where I was trying to contact the long lost son. And the reason that I'm saying this is because it's really happening. Like, it's happening right now.
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't even know if that's necessary.
It's going to go one of two ways. It's either going to really bring you in and make the film more realistic, or it's going to completely detach you. And, you know, I think it's a 50-50 shot. And for me, it's just detachment. I think you probably feel the same way there.
Yeah, well, I feel like the film is trying to be all, hey, you know how you're watching a film where there's a scene in it?
Right.
What if one of the characters was talking about the scene you were watching as yeah. if it weren't a film?
Yeah, it's a little too showy.
Yeah.
Now, I pick on all this stuff because I think the film, as far as the substance of it goes, is well written, and I think it's really powerful. I think when you kind of tack these devices onto it, it really takes away from it.
Yeah.
It detracts from that substance, and it kind of, you know, it underestimates its audience. We complain about that a lot on this show. I should say I complain about that
yeah,
a lot
you do.
On this show. But you really, you don't need to tell your audience that it's a film. They understand that. You don't need to like shove these coincidences down its throat. I mean, you have a powerful piece here. I really like, I want to commend this. I want to say, hey, good job on the film. Why do you need this other stuff in
yeah.
here? I think it just detracts from it. Let's just move into our A-list cast, because we're going to come back to this coincidence thing when the frogs happen.
Yeah.
We have what I think is a great performance by Tom Cruise. The further away I move from this film, you know, the longer it's been since I've seen it, the one thing that always sticks with me is I have to keep that film if for no other reason than, hey, Tom Cruise is doing something interesting here.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Cruise is an actor we've both spoken out against, mostly because he's a nut job, right? I mean, yeah. Is that it?
Well, yeah, I mean, he's not that great of an actor, too. He plays Tom Cruise in all his movies.
Yeah.
A really good example of like the Tom Cruise role being like, you know, Jerry Maguire.
Right.
Where he like slides around and he's really energetic and he points at everyone and he smiles a lot.
Yeah.
He does that in this role, but he does it kind of in a role where that's allowed. Instead of a role where he's like, I'm an average guy. I'm just really excited. He's like, hey, I'm a fucking telemarketing prank.
Well, and so this is a really cool role too. It kind of reminds me of the like Christopher McDonald Requiem stuff. There's a lot of infomercial stuff kind of going on in the background here. This is right after he did Eyes Wide Shut, another film we're just hitting them all today.
Mm-hmm.
Another film we've done on the show. And he kind of, you know, he had this sort of, I don't want to say a reclusive character, but he's kind of a beaten character in that.
Mm-hmm.
He's just, you know, on the bad side of every situation in that. And he's a little bit of an introvert, I think. And you move to a role like this where he got to really kind of explode on screen. He got to really be out there, like definitely to a fault.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, as a character, that's the problem with this guy is he's, you know, he's dirty, he's slimy, and he's really, really outspoken about it. I mean, he's like, he's monetizing off of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is his financial success. It's what he's doing as a living, is being a proponent of this like sleazeball scam. And he was hesitant to pick up that part,
mm-hmm.
but I think that's part of what kind of convinced him to do it. I also want to go back to crediting Paul Thomas Anderson again for really trying to take control of the promotion of this film. When he did Boogie Nights, it was something that he didn't think the studio marketed very well. And so he said, you know, this time around, he wants to cut his own trailer. He came up with his own poster. I mean, he really had a hand in how this film went out there.
Yeah.
And I think had he not done that, the studio would have gone with, hey, look at this Tom Cruise picture.
Right.
And he tried to focus more on the ensemble cast. I mean, you have Julian Moore, who's done, you know, a mixed kind of bag of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've pointed out, you know, at both ends of the spectrum, you have Children of Men.
Right.
And
The Forgotten.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's that. Philip Seymour Hoffman, this role was written for him as a standard man,
mm-hmm.
as your everyday kind of like as a redeemable character, because
yeah.
he always plays. He's the pedophile. He's the pervert.
Yeah.
He's the slimy guy. He's Truman
Capote.
He's yeah. Right. He's like pasty and yeah. awkward. And
he's a great actor. Don't
yeah,
get me
absolutely.
So we talked briefly as the film began and I saw him. We talked briefly about how I like him as an actor.
Yeah.
I think his film choice is something that just doesn't appeal to me.
Yeah. Well, and we found him almost accidentally in a lot of the like bad films
yeah.
that we've kind of looked
like
for.
Happiness was yeah, right. really. Well,
that was a film that didn't come to us. We mm-hmm. kind of searched yeah. it out. You know, you
right.
found this thing and I think you told me
yeah.
about it. And it was just like, look at this like dirty, awful, where did this come
yeah.
from? And it just happened to have
right.
Philip Seymour Hoffman. So we find him in a lot of that
stuff. I think he's a great actor.
Yeah, for
I
sure.
mean, I just personally, the films he chooses to do are not films that appeal to me.
All right.
That being
I've
said, it's really strange because he does a lot of films with William H. Macy, who
yeah.
you and I both agree we would like seek out
yeah,
to
sure.
see William H. Macy film.
Yeah, always interesting and stuff. Well, and it's weird that Philip's role of Phil in this
mm-hmm.
film was written kind of as almost the only character in this who doesn't have this weird, twisted, dark
yeah.
thing to him. I mean, even you get this great scene where he's ordering the food
yeah.
and he orders all the smut as well.
Yeah, right.
All
he orders Playboy, Penthouse, and Larry Flint Weekly.
And you fall back into that like, oh, look, he's a creepy, slimy guy. But it turns out he was just looking for the guy's son. So he's still like the stand-up character in this. William H. Macy, interesting story for him too. I really
and no
like
mustache.
That. No mustache. I like that break-in criminal aspect to him.
Mm-hmm.
You get a lot of some of the stuff that was touched on in Boogie Nights, a lot of the themes about homosexuality, about isolation, about alienation. You have a little kid, Dixon, little kid, what's the other one? Stanley.
Yeah.
Old guy whose story doesn't do a whole lot for
yeah,
me.
Yeah, old guy from The Matador.
Yeah.
Who's more
know.
Exciting in The Matador.
Oh, no. I'm all right with him.
Oh.
Other old guy.
Oh, yeah.
Old
dead
guy.
Old guy.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And then you have John C. Reilly.
Yeah.
This is the first time I'd seen John C. Reilly.
Oh, really?
When I saw this. Yeah.
Okay.
And then I saw him again in Criminal. And, you know, I'm not just going to start listing people's filmographies
right.
here. You know what John C. Reilly's in.
Haldega Knights.
Who unfortunately.
Step Brothers.
No, don't list them. That's what
Walk
we're trying
Hard,
to
the
avoid.
Dewey Cox story.
But don't pretend that there wasn't a point when you didn't like John C. Reilly, too.
Did,
I mean,
like,
his recent filmography has been bad, right?
Yeah.
But the early stuff was good,
I
right?
didn't see... Okay, so I didn't see a whole lot of his early
oh,
stuff.
All right.
I saw Criminal. I think there was maybe
You've
one,
seen
or,
some of the same stuff
one or two other films that I had seen him
yeah.
in. But never anything like this
yeah.
prior to Shake and Bake and fucking
yeah.
all that bullshit. But I really like him in this a
yeah.
lot. I mean... First off, and I mentioned this to you while we were watching the film, he watched so much Cops
yeah.
before this role.
He's written as this kind of simpleton cop.
Mm-hmm.
And the film, it does something really interesting in that on a surface level, that's really all he is. But the film is warm about that. You know, it doesn't
yeah.
try and do this sort of backhanded thing of you think he's a simpleton, but look how, you know... Look how smart and cunning he actually is.
Right.
It does something I think is more honorable. It says, hey, this guy is a simpleton, but look how redeeming that is.
Yeah.
You know, he's an everyday guy and he monologues a bit here and there. And
yeah.
what I think are kind of the more coherent monologues
mm-hmm.
in the piece. You get this idea that he's the guy who really gets it. He knows kind of what's going on here and he doesn't have all that other stuff. Because the more complicated characters, I mean, their complications are what's making their life, I guess that's the nature of the word, right? Making their life difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, their lives are complicated. They're complicated people. You have this simple guy who's managed to kind of see through everything that's going
yeah.
on here.
Right.
He kind of gets it down to brass tacks.
Yeah.
And I think that's really redeeming of
well,
his character.
And
I really
furthermore,
like that about
he's
it.
One of, if not the only character that like never really gets it hard.
Yeah.
The worst things that happen to him is he loses his gun,
yeah,
which he finds when it rains frogs.
Yeah, big embarrassment for
yeah,
him.
But his problems are like, you know, comparatively to the rest of the cast.
He doesn't have drug issues. He doesn't have sexual orientation
right.
issues.
He's not
have,
dying. His
right.
father's not dying.
He doesn't have cancer.
So there's this scene, which I didn't really know I wanted to talk about, but apparently I did, where he and Claudia are on their date.
Yeah.
And she does this thing where she's like, we need to be honest with each other and I'm on cocaine.
Yeah.
And he's like, okay. And he just like does it. And you're like, you didn't change your character at all because you're just a really straightforward, honest guy.
Well, that's one of the ways I think the script kind of points out like, hey, look how much this is really working for this guy. A guy you maybe up until that scene just dismissed as like, haha, simpleton cop, almost comic relief.
Where the dirtiest trick he played was pouring out the coffee.
Yeah, right. And once you get to that moment, you're like, oh, he's the good, honest stand-up guy. That's working out for him.
Uh-huh.
And this is something this other complicated character is just now trying to do. And it's almost a craft that he's mastered.
Mm-hmm.
In light of our recent conversation during the terminal about the kind of three-act thing, here's a film that's almost exactly 3 hours long. And Anderson almost divides it by acts exactly at the hour points. I think you would say the acts probably fall at the title cards with the weather, right?
Mm-hmm.
Your transition at the end of the first act is kind of this, the worm scene. And then you have the motion swipes between kind of what each character is doing at the time.
Mm-hmm.
At the 2 hour point, that's right about when you're getting Earl's big monologue, which I guess is the summary of the second act.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when you, and pacing here is what really made me notice this. Because the film is 3 hours and I always dread the long films, but I think the way particularly it was scored, it feels like almost the entire second act, which is usually your downtime, is where it feels like the climax.
Right.
Even though it's not, it's mostly building. But I think if we're going to look at what passed fastest while we're watching this film between the first hour and the third hour.
Yeah, probably.
That body right there, the whole thing, it had this constant momentum where you're cutting from character to character to character.
Well, yeah, you have all the like stories kind of hitting what you think is the high point. You have all the kids at the game show.
Sure.
The cop and Claudia doing their little like date type thing.
You have that downward spiral that William H. Macy's character is going through, that whole bar scene there.
You have the over at Earl and Lily's pad, you have... Philip Seymour Hoffman trying to get a hold of the long lost son. And then you have Julianne Moore, like getting the prescription
getting the drugs and getting,
and it's
upset.
Basically everything that you think is winding up to what is the end of the film.
Right.
Which is actually an hour later.
Yeah. I mean, then you get your third act, which is right about the breaking point for Donnie, which is where he decides to rob the place. That's where you kind of get the date turning sour. You get a lot of your big third act stuff and you get the frogs, which is this big turn in the film.
Mm-hmm.
The most common thing, I think if you go on something like Rotten Tomatoes, you will probably find hundreds of people, thousands maybe, that say, hey, this film was pretty good until that frog scene. What was that about? So no one, for whatever reason, no one really talks about the frogs.
Yeah.
I think they avoid it because they don't like it and it's weird. And to me, those are the most curious pieces and I need to talk about those.
Yeah, you have a movie where it's this ensemble cast doing this semi-art, you know, it's not semi, it's very artistic.
It's Crash,
kind of,
right?
It's a philosophical, like personal social film where you're like examining all these people's different problems and then suddenly you're swamped with frogs.
To go back to the film Crash,
Paul Haggis.
Yeah, one of his really, his only directorial things. He's a writer of a lot of different stuff. It's another film about interconnected stories. The parallels between the two movies border on plagiarism, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You have a lot of the same stuff, a lot of the interconnected story things, a lot of the crazy event at the end that kind of brings everybody together. Here you have these, I don't know if you picked up on this, it took me a couple times, but you have these constant allusions to 8-2.
I saw the one that I didn't even understand.
82, the numbers 8 and 2.
Yeah.
Which one did you catch?
The rope.
Yeah, I won't hit on all of them. They're in the beginning. Pieces, they're sprinkled throughout the film, the apartment numbers, phone numbers, stuff like that. You have a couple ways to kind of explain this frog scene. I'm curious if we can get through it and explain it without invoking the supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that appears in the Bible. It's an obvious biblical reference, but I'm not sure that's the origins as far as the writing in the movie.
Uh-huh.
You have Exodus 8-2, which is the, you know, Exodus is the story with Moses in the desert and the Pharaoh, and we're probably all familiar with it. It's the threat of raining down frogs. You know, let the people go. There's going to be a plague of frogs.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can say that the parallel is obvious here.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can say the film's trying to point you out to Exodus 8-2.
Right.
There's even a point during the game show where someone is holding a sign that says Exodus 8-2.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty sure it's not an accident here.
Right.
Although the way Anderson...
I saw that one too.
Well, who, by the way, Anderson is cameoing as the person who pulls out the person with the Exodus 8-2 sign. So yeah, I think it's pretty obvious, but I think it's stuff that was thrown in as hints after the fact. Because he describes this as a scene where he became really like obsessed with the strange frog idea while he was writing the film. Mm-hmm. He talks about reading a lot of Charles Fort stuff early, like 20s and 30s, about this frog phenomenon, which apparently actually exists.
Okay.
It's something that was written about in Scientific American. The idea is violent storms or tornadoes can pick up just these swarms of amphibians and right. chuck them down, and it's like it's raining frogs. It certainly doesn't happen as fantastically as in the film, but that's the nature mm-hmm. of film. It's more thematic.
Right.
I think the sound mix here, I mean, when you talk about sound mix, is killer.
Yeah.
You almost get what's a scare shot in the right. car.
Well, I would also say that the timing is really good.
Yeah, because, for sure.
I mean, we were talking about how this film's been 3 hours long, and yeah. we're kind of wrapping up the third hour. And regardless of how much you're digging the film and how into it and how like okay you may be with a 3 hour film, all the stories are starting, you know, they're starting to
draw. 2.5 hours is the hardest yeah. mark of the
and
3 hour
so
film.
So you have all these characters and all these stories, and you know, you can't really see where it's going. You yeah. can't really see what's gonna happen. I mean, there's definitely points where you're like, things are kind of gonna wrap up here, but you're right. not really sure how. And all the stories are drawing flies, and then suddenly John C. Reilly's like, "What are you doing, dummy?" And he turns around, and then
yeah, it just nails the car. And the sound mix is incredible on the surround here. It really sounds like it's raining frogs. It's apt in a movie where sound mix has almost been devoid, except for, again, the score that's great, this great right. building score. The third part of the movie is almost completely silent in regards to score, and then you get the pickup with yeah, the frog stuff.
I noticed that too.
A lot of people are going to say that Stanley or Dixon are prophets here. They're going to invoke religion. They're going to say that God is sending down these frogs, which maybe, okay, maybe. Mm-hmm. I'll say that's a place this film can go. The film does discuss religion a bit here and there, particularly John C. Reilly's character,
yeah.
who is not necessarily religious, but talks to God or has a mm-hmm. belief in God, or just talks to himself in the car. Maybe he needs an excuse to talk to himself right. in the car.
Or that's maybe fine. His nickname for himself is Jesus.
Dixon kind of gives this rap early on where he talks about, you know, God making it rain or whatever. Mm-hmm. Stanley, and this is, as far as execution goes, I mean, I'm okay with the frogs. First time I didn't like it because I was like, what the fuck? But I find upon watching this movie again, the thing that gets me through the 3 hour film yeah. is knowing the what the fuck scene is coming.
I think that the film without the frogs wouldn't be worth its weight
you
in
like the
fucking
frogs?
Dirt. Yeah.
Weird. That's weird coming from you. I was worried you wouldn't like that. You're also a big fan of that, the kind of collaborative singing.
Yeah. The yeah. American Idol.
Yeah,
the Magnolian right. Idol.
Yeah. Everybody's kind of coming together.
Yeah.
And say, another scene that I thought was a bit showy, but it's still, I really, it
well,
certainly
I think,
marks
I think,
another
I think without a doubt, it's Paul Thomas Anderson being like, yeah, William fucking H. Macy, Tom Cruise, and Philip Seymour Hoffman yeah. are all singing in my movie.
Yeah. Nothing wrong with that, I
nope.
guess. I think you can get around invoking the supernatural or invoking God to explain the frogs. You're looking at an event again. So there's some scientific background, and maybe this is just where I want to go with it. But Anderson talked about how he wrote the part in without even really understanding what it meant, which I don't know if that's ever a good idea, but okay. One mm-hmm. way to do things. And he said, you know, he only really understood it after the fact, that it was kind of about not having control and just this point where something just completely insane just makes sense to you. I think he likened it to a doctor telling you have a fatal disease.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just like, all right, so it's raining frogs. It's just this event. It's so ludicrous. It just seems like it's going to have such a strange impact on your life and you have no control of it. And so the thing in execution, I think, kind of fails about this is the thing I commented on before, where they really hammered in the, this is actually happening.
Yeah.
Which maybe they need, because otherwise the threat I would be railing against here is, yeah, that it's a dream, right? People wouldn't be saying the children are prophets because they talked about this. They would be saying, oh, this was just a dream that all the characters are having. So maybe that is necessary. Mm-hmm. Maybe you do need the quick zoom in shot of this is really happening.
Yeah.
I like that. But at the point where you get to Stanley and he's like, this really happens.
Yeah.
Over and over. And I'm yeah. like, I don't know. I mean, it's followed up by that really slow kind of high frame rate shot of the frogs falling in the background,
yeah.
which I think is kind of cool. So I guess I'm willing to let all that stuff go.
I like the frogs.
This is a good point where you have all the characters coming together over this really kind of bizarre event. And I think it serves to further draw in these parallels. So if you want to know more, Google's your friend. But I think that's really all we need to do here.
Yeah, let's just hop right into Kinky Boots.
So Kinky Boots is your film.
This Kinky Boots is my film.
Or me.
First off, I need to point out that we are now treading into the themed double features.
Yeah.
This one kind of borders outside of the theme.
Yeah.
only because when we were kind of pairing them up, we had like some fringe, like, well, these kind of maybe fit together. Plus, sure. It's doubly difficult because neither of us have seen the other one's film.
Well, so we're and like, well, one it sounds of the films like, was 3 hours.
Right. Well, so. you're like, it's artistic. I'm like, okay, well, yeah, this is artistic. But I think we went two different.
I believe I described Magnolia as artsy. And yeah. You're like, Kinky Boots is artsy.
It is artsy.
Yeah.
But it's artsy in a completely different way.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. So Kinky Boots it's a British film. Mm-hmm. It was super like under the radar. It came out in like AMC for a week in the suburbs.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember when it came out.
Yeah. I went and saw it because I really, at the time then, but also now, was a really, really big Chiwetel Ejiofor fan.
Uh-huh.
I need to say that slower for everybody who's listening intently. That's Chiwetel Ejiofor.
Wow.
Who plays Lola in
you
this film.
You got that down.
Because I really like him and I have to mention his name a lot.
Yeah.
He was in Children of Men.
Fantastic.
He's in Serenity.
Also fantastic.
He was in a recent film called Red Belt.
I
you didn't see that.
I don't know what that is.
Point of the story is I've never seen him. Not only have I never seen him do a bad film, I've never seen him not be great in a film. So that's why I went and saw this film in the first place, was because A, Chiwetel Ejiofor, B, in drag.
All right.
I didn't really know much about the film.
Mm-hmm.
So the film is inspired by true events. It's really loosely based on like a British factory that makes boots for transvestites or drag queens, you know, depending on how attractive you are.
Right.
So here we have a film, and this is something that I think is notable specifically for this show, because this is a film that under normal direction, normal acting, normal writing would be a really standard Saturday afternoon film.
Or really campy.
Yeah.
I hate to use the word camp to describe so many different things. It would be cheesy.
Yeah.
It would be a corny film.
So, I mean, it could have been something. And the other thing that you tread when you're doing drag queens or transvestites in film is something like Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, where it's like, oh my God, these guys are in drag and the film has no plot.
Right.
This film completely like the drag, it's a B story that helps the A story, you know, progress.
For sure.
And the reason that I think this film is notable is because despite all these like big, like minefields of problems when this film would be like in production and people would pitch it, it kind of like dodges everything it could have done wrong.
Give me an example.
I mean, first off, I already mentioned the drag queen thing.
Sure.
Where instead of being like, oh my God, isn't it silly how in drag they are?
Yeah,
it's like, this is a character who's in drag and sometimes he's not going to be in drag. And we'll touch on that once and then we're going to drop it because that's not the point of the film.
Yeah.
Which is, that's a subject that most films in drag, like even Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Sure.
They're like, oh my God, he's in drag.
Yeah.
For like 30 minutes.
Yeah. Well, that, I mean, you're dealing with a cult classic.
Yeah.
And that's part of the reason I think it went there, because it's so focused on that element. I think as film, we've kind of moved past that now, you know, where if you look at different eras of drag portrayed on film, I think we're kind of in an era now where I don't know that I'd even necessarily like push it to a B story, but I think it's more, to lend itself to the story. I think you focus less on it as a taboo. Look at a film like, the one we double featured with, Fur.
Oh, Dirty Shame.
No, but that's what I meant. Sorry. I was
Fur.
What was the, Fur. Look at a film like Fur, where you're dealing with such an outlandish, like weird taboo that is the centerpiece of your film. I think we've had enough films with drag as the central taboo that's focused on.
Sure.
I mean, you never have enough films about anything, you know,
right.
even Will Ferrell doesn't have enough films where he's coaching a soccer team.
Mm-hmm.
Like just keep making more and more films. That's fine. But I think you do have an abundance of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would never say enough, but
right.
an abundance. And I think you look at a story like this and you go, all right, well, that's a component of it. But where do you go with that story?
Right.
You know, how is it a piece of the story rather than just the focal point?
And the other thing that this film dodges, which I think it does incredibly well, especially for a film like a film with the kind of plot that it has, is it artfully dodges the romance story.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I found a little bit almost strange, you know, because you have the romance moment that appears at the end of the film, but that is like, it's almost booted back to C story.
So the romance story kind of has like the standard, you know, Saturday afternoon Hallmark Channel fucking thing where you have a guy and a woman, and the woman thinks the guy's going nowhere. So she cheats on him and then ends up leaving him. But meanwhile, this guy's like blinded by his ambition and doesn't realize that he's becoming like the object of affection for this other girl.
Yeah, right.
And like the audience can see that happening, but the film's like, yeah, but that's not what we're dealing with here.
Yeah.
Like the end of the film, there's like this cute little like go stand by your man thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's Charlie and the girl whose name I can't think of right now.
Yeah, sure.
And Lola in a scene at the very end instead of just the two of them. And it's like, yeah, they're kind of like together, but the film's about everybody.
Yeah, I think when you got to that particular moment after they have the big fashion show, mm-hmm. They're really trying to pitch the boots at the end, which it's kind of the climax of the film.
Right.
And I feel like maybe is a bit over the top, but in a movie with drag queens, that's where you need it. You need to have like a musical mm-hmm. number
sure.
climax or it doesn't work.
Yeah.
I can't write a film about drag queens, yeah, so maybe exactly. I don't know what I'm talking about. But you do have that moment that to me felt forced because you didn't have that. You didn't focus on the relationship right. beforehand. So when you get the two of them and they're kissing and you're like, well, I guess that's part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that was made a little bit lighter because you see the three of them standing there at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, I kind of felt like, well, is the film trying to tell me that this was an angle of the story that's a focal point? And, you never want to get to a point in the story and go, that's what this is about.
Yeah.
Like how many times has that happened on the show mm-hmm. where we're kind of like, wait, that's where we were going.
Right.
But you get to the end of this and you see the three of them and you're like, so this is still about the people and their lives and what they're doing here. Still, at that point when I see it, I mean, that's how I'm going to feel mm-hmm. in the scene where they kiss. And it's right. like, well, I guess this has a scene where they kiss. I think it still falls prey to a little bit of the convention there.
Sure.
But it wants you to know that it's about more than that.
Yeah.
And I think that's good.
So another thing that I think the film does that I give it a lot of credit for, again, because of the type of film it is and the fact that there are drag queens,
mm-hmm.
is the humor in the film is so like not about drag queens.
Yeah.
There's drag queen jokes, but they're almost less about drag queens and more like, if drag queens were watching the film, they'd be like, yeah, that's totally how people who don't like drag queens are.
Right. You get this moment, I think, where I kind of feel like they shrug that off between our lead, whose name I can't pronounce.
Charlie. Oh, she would tell us you for.
I'm just going to go Lola on this because mm-hmm. that'll just make it easier for me. You get this moment between Lola and Nick Frost's character. You think they're setting up this dynamic where his opinion of Lola is going to change.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it does.
Yeah.
But they make that a focal point. They go, change your opinion about somebody, change the way you think about somebody. And it feels like a very handed to you deliverance of, okay, change your feelings how you feel about Lola. But then it's revealed that that's not the route he took. Mm-hmm. It was actually his feelings for Charlie that, he was focused on and what he kind of turned around on and would eventually led everybody back to another moment in the film where I kind of feel like I'm not sure if I bought it.
Yeah.
Where he somehow rounded everybody up to come back.
Yeah.
I never like these moments in films where you kind of get this. Sports movies do this all the time, which is, I'm not a sports guy, but I would be able to do sports films if they didn't always fall prey to this.
Sure.
I'm not a war guy, but I saw Saving Private Ryan this week. You know what I mean? But sports films always have this moment where like the team's down and then they like bring everybody back.
Or the Space Jam Mike's Magic Stuff moment.
Yeah.
Where Bugs is like, it's Mike's Magic Stuff. And then everybody drinks water and they're like, okay, now we can do this.
Yeah, absolutely. You always have this recollection.
We need to call it the Mike's Magic Stuff.
That's fine. Yeah. Okay. That's fine. We have a Mike's Magic Stuff moment here. And everybody rallies back and comes to work late in the night. And I mean, I get it. There's suspension disbelief in its film, but
mm-hmm.
I just have to try and imagine the lost scene there where Nick Frost goes home and calls everyone on the roster to come back to work. It just seems a little odd to me.
There's always the possibility, and they kind of allude to it. And this is just me defending the film blindly.
Sure.
They showed earlier that everybody goes out to that bar after work.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's not like everybody's been home for a long time because Nick Frost is leaving when he overhears the fact that Charlie remortgaged his apartment.
So if I can guess where you're going with this, I believe you're saying it's possible that he heads home to the bar, sees everyone who works there, and then is like, hey, let's go back to the factory.
He sees the majority of the people.
Okay. Okay. I guess I mean,
that's just an argument I could pose.
No, it just seems like it's one of the few cliches
I agree.
When we talked about Magnolia, we tore it apart and I really do think it's a good film, but it has a couple little things where I'm like, I felt like it really injured it.
Yeah.
And I felt like rather than just praise the film over and over on this, we can kind of find these strange little things. And I felt the same way with Kinky Boots. It had, you know, it is kind of a feel good film.
Yeah. That's what I was getting at, is that it does that, but like,
which I thought was a lost genre, but I'm seeing more and more things, you know, more and more feel good films where it's like, they're getting really close to making good, solid, artistically satisfying films that aren't just, you know, simple Sunday afternoon, go to the theater kind of things to take home and not really think.
Yeah.
Stuff that you don't want to rewatch. Like you said, you know, Saturday afternoon movie channel.
Alan kinda, Thicke, Corey Haim.
Yeah, right. You have these films now that you're slowly starting to get to the point where they realize the cliches, they realize what makes them just bland films, and they're starting to get rid of them.
The one thing that this film does do that, you know, most feel-good films fall prey to, and we have to take it to task for, is the boot-making montage.
Yeah. I think that's okay if you do a movie where people make boots.
Yeah.
I mean, at some point.
You sure there's no, like, development there that could happen with the boot-making?
All right. See, I would disagree with you, and I'm probably wrong, but I didn't, you know, I'm going to be honest. I didn't even notice it.
Okay.
You know, if I'm watching a montage and I don't go, oh, shitty montage, what's going on here? Then I think I'm okay with it because there is a certain degree of fashion to it, and people who are into fashion, into drag, into catwalks.
Sure.
I mean, fans of some hybrid of Zoolander and the Devil Wears Prada, you know, they go to see films like this and they want to see the production of really, really stylish boots.
And I mean, and they had the, they had all the machinery there, and like, it's boring to watch people make boots.
Right.
However, like, it's kind of fun to see the, like, Mr. Rogers picture factory boot thing.
Right.
Where you see them put the shoe on that thing and then it, like, it looks like it inflates and you're like, I want one of those to do to my pancakes.
Plus, I feel like those were some of the art house moments of this, where you had, you know, none of the actors are coming to the set. You have a tiny crew who goes in with, you know, art students who are like, all right, we need macro shots of boots being pressed and machinery working and colors and stuff. And I think, you know, it's a montage, and eventually 50 years into this genre, I think we'll see that stuff totally disappear. Mm-hmm. But I think for now, as we're making our transition, that's actually helpful to the film. It gives it, at least visually, some kind of artistic thing to latch onto, rather than these usual montages we see where it's like relationship building montages or real substitutes for character. This was like, there was an absence during the montage of any kind of character development or building, but it wasn't in substitute.
Right.
It was just, here we have a gap of time. We want to show some boots being made. Mm-hmm. We're compiling footage to show that. And I think I'm all right with that, at least for now.
Yeah,
you know, as the genre gets older and progresses, I think we'll see more satisfying stuff come out of it.
So earlier in the show, we watched Magnolia, which we discussed in depth, has an ensemble cast. Also, S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah,
the guy from S.H.I.E.L.D. is somebody in the B-roll that I forgot. This isn't exactly an ensemble cast because, you know, the names are incredibly limited. You can't pronounce the star's name.
Right.
Nick Frost is the only person anybody really recognizes from the film.
You can tell it's a British film when Nick Frost is in it. That's just how you know.
But on the other hand, like, the film goes out of its way to be like, this isn't just these people, you know. I mean, it's part of the message of the film, I guess. But it's not like just the big heads of the movie doing all the shit. They're like, look, all these like smaller roles are really like vital to the,
you
like,
have almost ensemble characters rather than ensemble cast.
And I think that that's a strength of the film, because that's something that the film is trying to like portray across, is like, it's not just me. It's not just Charlie from Northampton. It's Price's Shoes.
Well, yeah. And they hit on that really early too, in another thing that I think is more artistically satisfying and less feel goodery, if you will. When he's firing everybody.
Right.
I guess there's nothing feel good about firing everybody, but you know what I mean? It's not, that scene isn't necessarily there to lend, you know, it would be feel good if at the end they're slowing down in production and he needs to hire them all again. Like, that would be a feel good gimmick. Instead, it's there just to show you how tough his adaptation into taking over this business is, how he's struggling, how they're like in rough times, and how, you know, they stress this, how he doesn't like letting these people go. I mean, that's what really turns him around for Nick Frost's character.
Right.
To hear him talk about how he didn't like, you know, how much stock he puts in this company. Mm-hmm. He could sell it, but he doesn't want to.
Right.
You know, it's not even his thing. He was kind of just thrusted into this. And he didn't want to let these people go. You saw all their faces. They could have just passed it by and been like, oh, he had to leave 50 people behind. He had to make 50 people redundant.
Yeah.
But instead, they make a point of showing all the people. And the people, you're right, the people in the factory, it's an ensemble cast of characters, I guess, rather than actors. You know their positions, you know what they, you know what each of them does in the factory.
Like there's, you've got the one lady who's kind of, who kind of gets cranky and leaves, but she's kind of like the matron of all the females.
Sure.
And then you have the little, like, I don't know the what to call her. I would call her like a nuts and bolts lady, the makes the buttocks appear pert and ready for mating.
Right.
The lady, she just kind of seems like she goes around and like gives people stuff when they need it, like an assistant.
Yes.
And then you have Nick Frost and his like buddy,
right,
who are like the muscle.
Yeah.
You could give everybody like a the blank name if you were making a gang of the shoe factory.
Yeah,
but
for
then you'd have to throw Danny Trejo in the mix.
Well, and you get to know all these characters, which becomes really important. In the end, it's still about your three main characters, but you do have this background cast who's really important to the film.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing I think that, you know, in a lot of the feel good type movies, the background cast, you don't really know their faces. You just know that it's a gang,
right?
You know, it's the sports team, right? Mm-hmm. And you have like a couple different, you know, stereotypical
Yosemite Sam and Elmer Fudd and like maybe Wile E. Coyote.
You really want to keep going to the Space Jam.
I like Space Jam.
I'm not well versed enough in my Space Jam to keep going back to it.
Check Space Jam out again.
I always, you know, I always think about these really bland, I don't even want to mention any of these sports movies on the show, but you know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. And you have a team of like 20 players and you get to know the five stars.
Yeah. And then the other like characters have like, you're like, oh yeah, that's Catfish.
Yeah. Well, and there's such background is what I'm getting at, that you don't care about them. Mm-hmm. You don't really know what they do. And they're just there. So, it, you know, when the team's down in the fourth quarter, then
somebody
everybody can
pass
rally
the star
together.
The ball.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what they're there for. And here they're not there as a stepping stone for the lead actors.
Yeah. Like every single one of them has a really key point.
Yeah.
But it's kind of really nuanced, like a perfect example being the, I don't even know his name, the older guy with the glasses.
Gotcha.
He's like kind of around and he's like a cute old man, but like, were he not there, Charlie would never have known how to like make the boot support men.
Yeah.
He's like steel shank.
Oh yeah.
You're
yeah,
that was that guy. And if he weren't there, they would have been fucked.
So I think this is a film that a lot of films of the genre should take note of.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's definitely not, you know, the pinnacle.
Yet. Oh, sure.
You
not
know,
at
we
all.
We're not even close to that point, but I think we're getting there. We're working towards that. And I think this, maybe we're reading into it too much, but I think this might be a pivotal role in doing that. I think it might be
one of
the key steps towards it. You know, you look at a scene that comes to my mind, like, in dealing with the drag queen thing. Because in a movie where you have a drag queen, that's certainly one of the points that you want to touch on, even if you don't want it, like we said before, to be the focus. You have Lola in her room when the older woman comes in.
Yeah.
And literally in a film where they would have gone on to deal with the do they know if it's a man or a woman thing for so long, you literally have just this one scene that does it in such a beautiful, perfect, simple way.
Yeah.
Where they're having a normal conversation. And then she asks Lola, oh, by the way, are you a man? Like just so simple, straight out. And Lola's basically like, oh yeah. And she's like, all right, I just want to know if I should put the toilet seat up or down.
Yeah.
And that was it. You know, it says so many things just in its simplicity.
Mm-hmm.
There's that curiosity. This person wants to wonder, it's a normal question and you don't, you know, it's a taboo. You don't know how to deal with it.
Right.
And I think that's such a simple, like cut and dried kind of, oh, by the way, are you a man?
Yeah.
Okay. Just want to know. I'll see you later.
Mm-hmm.
And it's notes like that. You know, there's so many little things like that, that I think the nuance of that is what should be picked up from this film
and
used in films to come.
Absolutely.
Also more films that we are doing.
We've got more films because this show is a doublefeatureshow.com.
Go to doublefeatureshow.com. Send us an email.
And we do multiple movies each show.
Next time we're doing a show.
Four films. We're doing Me and You and Everyone We Know and Primer.
The two films we're actually doing are Me and You and Everyone We Know is film number one. And Primer is film number two. We're going to make Primer film number two. I think.
We're going to have to.
So we never talked about Primer. I think before I wanted to mention it, we never really did. And it might be better for year two, but what the fuck? We're going to do it now. Is that the first time one of us dropped an F-bomb in this episode?
No, I've been...
Are we getting less explicit? I said
William fucking H. Macy. I know that for sure.
All right, cunt pickle. What was I saying? Oh, right, got it. It's the kind of movie you need a diagram to explain. I talked with you about this previously, about whether or not we were going to try and watch it a couple times first. And you being the double feature purist, wanted to go into it without you having seen it and with me having seen it. So this is an experiment, man. I don't know what's going to happen here. I don't know if this
is
going
to work. Well, here's the thing is if it doesn't work, we can always bring it back year two.
Yeah, that's true. We'll just come back to it and be like, no, seriously, what happened in this film? Yeah. Because I kind of want to go Attic Expedition style, or like when we did Waco,
where we just saw
Waco. Mm-hmm. I want to do the Attic Expeditions thing. I want to go, okay, here's what this film, maybe even if we don't touch anything about this film, because there's a lot to talk about, but I really just want to know what the fuck happened.
All right.
So that's a warning now to people. It's an hour long, this film. It's hella independent. It's like $7,000. Just came out in the last year. So you can get it for like $4 on DVD. Watch it 100 times before you listen to this show so that you will have some idea what we're talking about.
Cool.
Do you have any heads up for
me and you and everyone we know is like independent ad nauseum, and it's like super cutesy, weird, lots of dots.
All right.
Cool. Watch more fucking film, you cunts.
Bye. Do you have any kind of sound testing you would like to do?
Sound check. Rated R.